These arguments for the relativity of time, subsequently developed by Nagarjuna, are primarily philosophical, but the fact remains that time has been perceived as relative in the Buddhist philosophical tradition for nearly 2,000 years. Although I am told that some scientists view Einstein's four-dimensional space-time as a grand vessel with inherent existence in which events occur, for a Buddhist thinker familiar with Nagarjuna's arguments, Einstein's demonstration of the relativity of time, especially through his famous thought experiments, is extremely helpful in deepening the understanding of the relative nature of time. My grasp of quantum theory is, I confess, not all that good, though I have tried very hard. I'm told that one of the greatest of all quantum theorists, Richard Feynman, wrote, "I think I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics, so at least I feel I'm in good company." But even for someone like myself who cannot follow the complex mathematical details of the theory, in fact, mathematics is one area of modern science to which I seem to have no karmic connection at all, it is apparent that we cannot speak of subatomic particles as determinant, independent, or mutually exclusive entities. Elementary constituents of matter and photons, which is to say the basic substances, respectively, of matter and of light, can be either particles or waves or both. In fact, the man who won the Nobel Prize for showing that the electron is a wave, George Thomson, was the son of the man who won the same prize for showing that the electron is a particle, J.J. Thomson. Whether one perceives electrons as particles or waves, I am told, is dependent on the action of the observer and his or her choice of apparatus or measurement. Although I had long heard of this paradoxical nature of light, only in 1997, when the experimental physicist Anton Zeilinger explained it to me with detailed illustrations, did I feel I had finally managed to grasp the issue. Anton showed how it is the experiment itself that determines whether an electron behaves as a particle or as a wave. In the famous double-slit experiment, electrons are fired one at a time through an interference barrier with two slits and are registered on material such as a photographic plate behind the barrier. If one slit is open, each electron makes an imprint on the photographic plate in the manner of a particle. However, if both slits are open, when a large number of electrons are fired, the imprint left on the photographic plate indicates that they have passed through both slits at the same time, leaving a wave-like pattern. Anton brought an apparatus that could repeat this experiment on a smaller scale, so all the participants had great fun. Anton likes to remain very close to the empirical aspects of quantum mechanics, grounding all his understanding in what we can directly learn from experiments. This was quite a different approach from that of David Bohm, who was primarily interested in the theoretical and philosophical implications of quantum mechanics. I later learned that Anton was and remains a strong advocate of what is called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, while David Bohm was one of its strongest critics. I must admit I'm still not quite sure what the full conceptual and philosophical implications of this paradox of wave-particle duality might be. I have no problem in accepting the basic philosophical implication that at the subatomic level, the very notion of reality cannot be divorced from the system of measurements used by an observer and cannot therefore be said to be completely objective. However, this paradox also seems to suggest that, unless one accords some kind of intelligence to electrons, at the subatomic level, two of the most important principles of logic, the law of contradiction and the law of the excluded middle, appear to break down. In normal experience, we would expect that what is a wave cannot be a particle. Yet at the quantum level, light appears to be a contradiction because it behaves as both. Similarly, in the double-slit experiment, it appears that some of the photons pass through both slits at the same time, thus breaking the law of the excluded middle, which expects them to pass through either one slit or the other. Regarding the conceptual implications of the results of the double-slit experiment, I think there's still considerable debate. Heisenberg's famous uncertainty principle states that the more precise one's measurement of an electron's position, the more uncertain is one's knowledge of its momentum. And the more precise one's measurement of its momentum, the more uncertain one is of its position. One can know at any one time where an electron is, but not what it's doing, or what it is doing, but not where it is. Again, this shows that the observer is fundamental. In choosing to learn an electron's momentum, we exclude learning its position. In choosing to learn its position, we exclude learning its momentum. The observer, then, is effectively a participant in the reality being observed. I realize that this issue of the observer's role is one of the thorniest questions in quantum mechanics. Indeed, at the Mind and Life conference in 1997, the various scientific participants held different nuanced views. Some would argue that the observer's role is limited to the choice of measuring apparatus, while others accord greater importance to the observer's role as a constitutive element in the reality being observed.